So what is class Pesach without the pain? The purpose of the class is to learn the laws of Passover in a way that will enable us to understand what we have to do, supposed to do, and what we don't have to do. And the reason why this is class is important is because as I've said in previous years, the party line about what one has to do for Pesach extends way beyond the obligations, and most people's perceptions of what they have to do are more than they do, and it puts a lot of pressure on people. It puts a lot of pressure on relationships. It puts a lot of pressure on people's ability to do the things that they want to do, and to come to Pesach and celebrate Pesach. They want to celebrate Pesach. So therefore, we're going to try to go through the laws quickly and get an idea of what our obligations are and like I said, what we could put aside, even though it says it in the literature nowadays. So we start. I brought this from one of the websites from the Hechsherim. I use it as first of all as an outline of stuff, just so I remember what the topics they touch upon are, but also because I was curious as to what their positions were in terms of what they obligate people to tell people they're obligated to do. And I'm just using this as an example to show you that they say things that are not required to do, even though they make it sound like it's required. So the first thing that it discusses is Bedikas Chametz, which is checking for Chametz. So I basically tell people that in terms of checking for Chametz, whenever you approach a holiday, you have to know your obligations. Remember, we had this discussion. So someone is observant. The first thing they have to do is, what are my obligations? So I always give an example like Purim. Purim comes. I'm going to have a good time. No. You have a good time, but you have four obligations. You have to have a suda during the day. You have to have a meal, festive meal. You have to listen to Megillah twice. You have to do matanot l'av your name, give the charity to the poor, special charity, not regular charity, special charity to the poor, whatever, $20. And then you have to, which means basically two gifts to two individuals. And the reason why it's $20 is because that costs about $10 for a meal, let's say. Maybe less, maybe more, depending on where you are. But assuming that you could buy a meal for $10 is pretty reasonable. You have to give two gifts to two poor people. And that's the equivalent of two gifts to two poor people. So it's $20 and matana of your name. And like we help you do that in shul. We have a fund for that. And then mishloach manos. So you got to give two items of food to one person. And then you have, that's how you have fulfilled the obligations you have for Purim.
Excuse me, do you have to listen to the Megillah in the morning and the evening? Is that the
yes.
It says twice, but does you have to do it?
Yes, definitely. It's definitely have to listen to it during the day, that's for sure. If you listen to it at night, that's an obligation, but it's not as serious as an obligation as during the day. Day is when you have to fulfill all the mitzvahs. So a lot of people look at it the opposite. They think the night's more important. Even though we have our main party at night, really the truth is the main part's supposed to be during the day or the next day, but it just doesn't work out logistically for us to do that. But technically speaking, the real party is supposed to happen during the day of Purim. But Pesach, same thing. You got to come to the holiday, and you got to figure out what are your obligations. That's what you have to. First thing you have to do. So, what are your obligations of Pesach? So, one of them, and probably the most complicated one, is the obligation to get rid of all the chametz in your house. And definition of chametz is the five grains that leavened. So it's wheat, spelt, oats, rye, and barley. Those five grains, if they rise, leaven, whatever it is, then, and we suspect that everybody is in that category. Every food that was not supervised for Pesach is in that category of leavened. Though we don't know, maybe it wasn't leavened. I don't know if it was leavened or not. Hi, guys.
Hey, how you doing? Hey. What a nice surprise. Come on, sit next to me.
Nice to see you. Thank you for coming.
Of course, I would late.
No problem at all. No problem at all. The more the merrier. We need more people. What? Yeah, that's right. We feel the glow. So we actually just began because we were schmoozing. We're talking about the concept of the class, which is to help everyone be able to focus on what has to be done, so to speak, in halacha, as opposed to what the websites say have to be done or should be done. Yeah, so that's what I mean, Pesach without the pain, it makes it a lot easier. So we want to focus on what is necessary, what is obligatory, what is extra credit. And extra credit to me is not something that one should engage in at all unless they really, for whatever reason, want to do it, because there's so many other things you're sacrificing. You're sacrificing your personal relationships, you're sacrificing the list of things that you got to do, we're all busy, and also going into Pesach as a normal human being. So if we focus on what we have to do, we're able to accomplish a lot more in terms of our personal lives and in terms of appreciating Pesach. So we start off with the fact that before every holiday, we have to make a list of, in our minds, of the things that we have to accomplish on the holiday, meaning the mitzvot. Because it's not Pesach. Most people go to Pesach, they say, oh, it's a holiday family. I think about the chicken soup, right? What am I going to serve? What am I going to eat? That's not. That's fine. That's important. I do the same thing, but in terms of halacha, one's supposed to think about what they're obligated to do. So, Pesach. The first thing is that there's a mitzvah called tashbisu. Tashbisu means you have to get rid of all the chametz in your house. And we define chametz as the five grains: wheat, spelt, oat, barley, rye. Those five grains, if they are not supervised for Pesach, so even though it's possible they didn't rise, sorry about that. Even though it's possible they didn't rise, it's actually Miriam. Even though it's possible they didn't rise, it doesn't matter because it's a biblical commandment, and therefore we have to be strict about it. And the rabbis are very strict about it because during the year we're used to eating it, and we could be very, if we're lenient about it, then we're not going to keep Pesach properly. So anything that has those five grains, we just assume that it's chametz and we don't eat it. And we got to get rid of it out of our house. So there's ways, how do we get out of our house? So one easy thing to do is just to sell your chametz. And that's why this is a custom that developed over the last few hundred years. It's not like an old-time custom. They used to not sell their chametz. They used to get rid of it. But selling your chametz is always, I always tell everybody to do it. Some people who don't do it because they don't believe in it, because they think it's fake. But the fact is, it's a custom among the Jewish people, and I say it doesn't hurt. I'll put your name on a list, and it'll be sold. And if you, it's a backup case. It's a situation where you need it. In halacha, it's always good to do that. It's a very simple thing to do. The other things you got to do for tashbis to get rid of chametz is also in your mind, which is called bittel. Bittel is done the night before Pesach, 24 hours before, and also the main one is done in the morning of the eve of Pesach. And that morning of the eve of Pesach, we actually say, any chametz that is in my possession is nullified. I consider it to be hefker. How you doing? Family affair. I consider it to be nullified and like the dust of the earth. And that's a legal declaration. It's not just like words. So that means you got to say it in English. You got to understand what you're saying. Most prayers you could say in Hebrew, and it's fine if you don't understand what you're saying because the Hebrew has special spiritual powers. But when it comes to bittul, first of all, every person has to say it on their own. I can't say it for you because I can't tell you, I can't say on your behalf that your chametz doesn't mean anything to you. I don't know. I can't do that. You're the only one that could say that. My chametz is like the dust of the earth. It doesn't mean anything to me. Possibly you could say for somebody else that your chametz is called hefker, which means that it doesn't belong to me anymore. It belongs, anyone could take my chametz. That's like a technical, legal act that possibly could be done by somebody else. But the other part of it, which is that the chametz is nothing, it's like dust of the earth, only that person does. So every person, I guess over the age of 13 even, should say this bittul chametz in the morning before Pesach. So that's another way we get rid of chametz, because that's like also like a backup in a sense, but it's a very powerful backup. It's actually biblical in nature that we say that all chametz I consider it nothing, and I consider it to be not in my possession anymore. I'm relinquishing possession. So that's the second way. The third way to get rid of chametz is to physically remove the chametz, right? And that's what we do called beer. Beer means to get rid of the chametz. And one of the things we do by beer is we burn the chametz. Now, I don't recommend that in the city to burn chametz. They have certain places, like in Lakewood, where they have an official burning station. You go to there, they have supervised fire. But nowadays, there's been so many accidents with fire. And I just think that it's so, the gain in halacha is so small. There is an opinion that says you're really supposed to burn it. And I'm not denying that. I'm just saying that the possibility of fire is so dangerous that I think it's not worth the benefit at all. So my recommendation is someone lives in the city, unless they have some way of accessing. And Hill, I think they have a big fire guy. I don't think it's worth it to waste your time to do it. I think you just flush it down the toilet. If you have chametz, or throw it in the garbage can out of your possession, that's it. Very, very, very simple thing to do. I don't think one is obligated at all to go through the process of burning it. Physically getting rid of the chametz from your property is a mitzvah, because you're fulfilling that mitzvah of tashbisu. And there are some opinions that even say that right now, or some say starting Rosh Chodesh on Saturday, anything you have in mind that you eat that's chametz, that you have in your house, is a mitzvah, because you're getting rid of chametz. That's a, eating is a perfectly legitimate way to get rid of chametz in your house. So the point is that physically getting rid of the chametz is another way that one can fulfill this obligation. That's probably the one that needs to be spent the most time on, because the other two are just declarations and just, simple things. This one is not so simple. So the way I divide up a house to make it very easy is in three parts. Part one is a place where you bring chametz into, like your kitchen. And for me, it's like my bedroom, right? Because we used to have a television in our bedroom, a computer, big computer, big monitor, and we watch Netflix, whatever it is on. And we have no problem munching away in our bedroom. So that our bedroom then becomes like our dining room, which is called the Makom Shem Machnisim Bo Chametz, place where chametz is brought into. So that, if someone won't dare to bring any food into their bedroom, they have no obligation to check their bedroom, because there's no reason to think that chametz is in your bedroom unless there's a reason. I had a family once that I was close with in Baltimore that they were so strict about chametz, so careful, that they told their kids that a week before Pesach, you eat in the hallway. You don't eat in the house anymore, right? So they the whole house was ready for Pesach a week before. So she told me, the mother, she said, look how God laughs at me. The last day of Pesach, she's rummaging around the house, and she looks behind her bookcase, and there's a donut right there behind the bookcase. Whole donut, Entenmann's donut. So she's like, why that happened? Because she has kids. So if you have a reason to believe that a kid, in the olden days, they used to worry about mice bring bread from place to place. So nowadays, the modern mice are men, are babies, are children, young children. So that's an example of some reason why you might think you have chametz in your bedroom, if you don't eat in your bedroom. But you don't have to check any place that you reasonably assume there's nothing there. So that means, I don't eat anything over my sock drawer. So therefore, that is not. I know people who like take out their socks and take out their underwear, and they vacuum everything from the drawers. That's not necessary to do on Pesach, unless you hide like Twix bars in your underwear drawer or something like that, which I know I heard some people do. But if you don't have any reason to think that this chametz there, you don't even have to put that on the list of checking and preparing for Pesach. It's off the list. And for many people, and I want to say most, but I don't know if everyone's this way, many people, this eliminates about at least 50% of the house, at least, sometimes 75% of the house. They don't have to be even checked at all. So spring cleaning is very nice if you want to do it, but it's not necessary for Pesach in these rooms. Second category of rooms is, let's go back. So that's Makom She'ein Machnis Bo Chametz. That's one category, the place that you don't bring chametz into. Then there's another category of Makom She'ein Machnis Bo Chametz, a place that you do bring chametz into, and that could be divided into two parts. Part A is everything but the kitchen. And there, what you're worried about is not crumbs of chametz, because no one's going to eat the crumbs of chametz. And the Torah's obligation is only what's known as a kezias, which is a significant amount of bread or chametz that you're not allowed to keep. The crumbs, the Torah does not obligate you to get rid of crumbs. The rabbis obligate you to get rid of crumbs only in situations where you might eat the crumbs in a way that's tasty, whatever, that benefits in any way. In other words, the crumbs are edible, right? Like in the kitchen. And we'll explain how that works. Like something, if a crumb of cookie crumb falls into your soup, rabbinically, the whole soup, you can't eat soup. Even if one crumb falls in. Because they were very strict about chametz. Because during the year, we don't eat, we eat chametz, we eat bread, we eat this stuff. So for 7 days, it's hard for us to be careful because we're used to eating it. So they were very stringent about these things to make a person, train a person, so that for the 7 days, they're careful. So when you're outside your kitchen, they didn't obligate the crumbs because no one's going to eat a crumb on the floor, on a carpet or on the floor. So what do they obligate? Only something called a gluska yafev, meaning like a size that someone would eat, like a Cheerio. So if there's, you know, if there's a Cheerio on the floor, so or like a Twix bar or something like that, then I don't know why it shows Twix. I just happen to like it. Yeah. Kit Kat.
Me too.
So if you have from Purim left over from Shalach Manas, you got to look for that type of stuff. But you don't have to sweep for crumbs. You don't have to wash the floors for crumbs. You just have to find edible food that's large enough that would be something that you would eat, like a Cheerio is an example I give. And that also really is not so hard to do. I mean, to find Kit Kat bars in places where, like in your dining room, you're not gonna find it. You know where your stuff is in your dining room. Even if you bring food into your living room, there's not food lying around. You should look for it, but you pretty much know your house. So the most complicated room is therefore the kitchen. And basically until now, we're talking about the first category, you spend 0 minutes and 0 seconds on that. And the second category, depending on your situation, maybe it'll take you 15 minutes. I don't see how it should take anyone longer than 15 minutes to check places in your house where you bring chametz into, but it's not the kitchen. So the thing that we're left over is the kitchen. The kitchen could potentially take days to... Yeah, we're up to it right now. Perfect timing. So just to quickly summarize what I just said, just so you know the context of our, is that we divided the house into three parts. One part is a place you don't bring chametz at all to, and you're sure of it. So you don't have to check that at all. The second is a place that you do bring chametz into that's not the kitchen. And then you have to only look for things that are edible. And then the third one is the kitchen. The kitchen, you have to worry about crumbs, right? Crumbs are an issue because one crumb will ruin your food. So what do we do about this? So this is one of the examples I'm giving you that it's without the pain. Because if you read the books online, things online, things they make people do are just like insane in the kitchen. I used to make my Pesach at my father's house in Monroe. Every year he would need to get some professional to fix his counters because of the layers of tinfoil and tape that were placed on it and cardboard, right? And one year he needed a new oven because the oven overheated because of the tinfoil. The place looked like a spaceship. And that I just followed the instructions of the book because I figured the book says it must be true. But then I realized, just like the internet, it's not necessarily true just because you see it in a book, right? In the book. So when I did my research, I realized that there's a very simple solution to this. And it means no counters have to be covered. No sink has to be covered. No boiling water pouring all over your whole kitchen, which like a lot of people do. I spoke to someone, they took a thing of urn, you could kill yourself, and poured it over all the counters and the sink. And they were like, it's going to ruin the counter. I'm like, you don't have to do it. And they still felt like they had to do it. They have to pour the hot water, even though they knew it was going to ruin the counters. And I was like, I don't understand this at all. Well, so there's a very simple solution. Nowadays, I always say the best invention is Windex and Fantastic and all these things. Because in halacha, if there's a crumb on your counter and you Windex it, it now becomes poisonous.
Inedible.
Worse than inedible. It's now pogum. It's come completely spoiled. You know, like I joke around, like if it might, you know, one crumb ruin your food. But a crumb with Windex on it is not food. So if it falls on your food, right, you're not violating Pesach. You might die if you eat it, but at least you died not eating chametz, right? So that's basically what we're talking about. So if you have a bottle of Windex, and especially if you have like someone to help you clean, all you got to do is tell them is to make sure that they clean very well every place where you put food, countertops, any cabinets you're going to use. Just Windex them all down, and that really takes care of the areas in the kitchen that have food on it that you're going to use for food. You do not need to cover anything, and we explained this last year in the sermon. And part of the reason is because you don't use countertops to cook. And cooking is what transfers. Most of the things you do on your counter don't transfer anything into the counter. And even if it did transfer into the counter, right, after 24 hours, any taste becomes what's known as pugum, becomes spoiled. So anything, people think like there's, you know, those commercials they had for the little bubbles?
Scrubbing
bubbles. You know what I'm talking about? What's the name of that spray?
It's good spray. You know,
it's good spray, yeah. But it's funny because you just imagine those little bubbles with like the little people, right? Because when you see the commercials. So people imagine that in your kitchen, you have these bubbles of chametz inside the pores of your countertop, waiting to come out and attack your matzah brei, right? And that's what these online things, you know, halacha articles make you believe. But the truth is, that's not the case. That there is no bubbles in your countertops, and the thing you do have to worry about is actual crumbs, and the Windex solves that problem. So the only thing you have to worry about beyond that, and that you should do on your sink also, because the sink, most of the time you don't have boiling chametz. It's not, you don't cook on it. It's like a countertop in that sense. So it doesn't receive real taste of chametz. Besides the fact that you usually use soap there. Soap is something that takes away taste from food, and that's an advantageous thing. So the only thing you have to worry about is cooking things you cook with, because that has a lot of heat, and that is what's known as a kli rishon. It's known as a first vessel, and a first vessel that you cook with is the thing you have to worry about transferring taste. So basically, the answer to that is very simple. Your oven, you should just clean it, so make sure there's no edible food. If it's burnt, it's fine. If it's burnt food, it's not edible. But just clean it. If you want to put it on self-clean, then that's all you got to do. Self-cleaning, done. Or just clean it with, what's it called? What's the spray called then? Oven spray? Easy off. If you want to use it, you don't have to use that. I'm just using it as an example. Some people don't like the fumes. But if you clean your oven the way you normally clean your oven, you burn it out for half an hour after you clean it, and then it becomes kosher Pesach. Very easy. And when it comes to your microwave, the microwaves I've tested don't get hot enough on the walls. So all you do is Windex the microwave and you're done. The only thing about it, though, is the microwaves I've tested, the plate at the bottom gets very hot. So even though there's an argument to be made that you don't have to do anything about that, because it's glass and there's other reasons, the best thing to do, I think, is just take saran wrap and wrap around the glass twice, two layers. And in halacha, that can't be penetrated. And then you can use your microwave the same way you do the whole year, if that's something that's palatable for you. If it's not, I think there's enough. You can Windex it down the same way you do everything else.
Don't you put it in the dishwasher, too? Take it off and put it in the dishwasher, or then wash it with real hot water or hot water under something?
Well, yes and no. It's, you're right. That could be a possibility, and it would help to a degree. There's some opinions that say you can't kosher glass, which is one of the things they take into consideration. So, dishwasher. I don't know if that makes a difference. But if you want to pour a bottle of hot water on it, I guess that would help to a degree. Some people like to steam out with boiling water in the microwave. So there's things you could do.
That's so odd with the glare thing. Because when I was raised, we used...
Yes. There's an opinion that says that it doesn't receive anything.
Right.
There's an opinion that says that. But Ashkenaz, Sfarim really are the ones that hold that way, and Ashkenazim hold that we treat it the opposite. Rav Ma says we treat it like pottery, which can't be kosher.
The difference between like glass you drink from with coal versus
that's also true.
With.
That's a very important point.
Yeah, but sometimes they used to, the Europeans would drink tea, hay, in a glass with a sugar cube.
So is tea the same thing as cooking
in? It's not cooking. It's like in between. It's like not cold, but it's not cooking. So it's like in between. So yeah, so it's true what you guys are saying. There's no questions what to rely on for a glass. But Pesach, we try to be, do things a little bit more than we do during the year. And therefore, this is something I don't think is crazy. I think that someone puts saran, it's very easy to do, put saran wrap around it.
Really?
But on the other hand, if you don't want to do it, I definitely see leniencies that you could rely on for sure. And one of them is what you're saying, is that it doesn't, you know, you can go back and forth between glass because glass doesn't receive any taste at all.
And you still have to boil water for 3 minutes in there? You know,
I don't think you have to do that. I think the Windex takes care of that. And it really is not a koshering thing for many reasons. The microwave walls anyway don't get hot enough, generally speaking. The plate, though, gets very hot. I'm not sure why that is, but, you know, technically. Anyway, that's a microwave. The refrigerator should be cleaned well because the crumb issue. So same idea. Every surface of the refrigerator, if you Windex it, then that's better. And then, clean it. If you have cleaning help, that's the easiest thing. Just tell them to clean out the refrigerator and clean it well. And you can rely on that. Yeah, totally right.
Oh, yeah.
Just tell them to get every...
I feel like they never do a good job.
Well, tell them to do a good job.
You get Gracie. She knows
yeah.
She does
Gracie does a great job. You get a good clean lady.
Yeah.
You know, they say that you need...
She sends other people in there, no?
Well, she only chooses good people.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Just tell the cleaning person to get all the surfaces of your refrigerator and make sure you clean it well. But I think you can rely on it because it's not like you're not relying on something that major, you know. If you can inspect it afterwards also and see if it's clean. So definitely clean out the refrigerator. The freezer is harder because of the ice and stuff like that. So, but you should, I mean, cleaning people clean freezers. So that's not so complicated either. I mean, and any chametz you want to keep, you should put aside either in the refrigerator, freezer, or a cabinet, depending on what kind of food it is, and just either designate a plastic bag, an area as chametz, and label it as such so that you don't take from it. You don't eat it on Pesach. That's the fear over here that's worried about. And then the rest of the refrigerator you could use like you normally would use because the chametz is put aside in a way that you won't take from it.
I thought you had to remove it.
Right, so there's two things. First of all, since we're selling it, and I'm basically assuming that the person is selling their chametz. Because if you don't sell your chametz, then you're 100% correct. You're not allowed to keep chametz on Pesach. You got to get rid of it. So I'm assuming that, like we said earlier, that we sold the chametz. So it's very important to make sure your chametz is sold if you want to keep chametz over Pesach. Because there's a rabbinical restriction on, besides the fact there's a biblical restriction to keep chametz in your possession, but even if you kept it after Pesach, you can't even eat it because there's a rabbinical restriction on keeping eating chametz that was kept in your property over the holiday. So really important to sell the chametz for that reason. But so it's a very good point. Yes.
What about keeping chametz that's not for human consumption?
Right. So we'll get to that in a minute. That's a good question. So animals is another thing. That's another category. But before we get to animal, there's a category like cosmetics. So the bathroom, I consider a place you don't have to check for chametz either because nothing in the bathroom, generally speaking, is edible unless maybe someone has, I don't know what, Tums? Tums is not chametz anyway. There might be something edible in the bathroom, but generally speaking, shampoos, if they have oats in them, are fine. And we explain why, you know, bottom line is the you know, eating shampoo, alcohols you don't have to worry about in cosmetics, even mouthwashes you don't have to worry about it because the alcohol, even if even if it's made of chametz, but it's not. No one's drinking a bottle of mouthwash. And some say, well, if you're alcoholic, you would drink it. So, but that doesn't mean it's fit for human consumption. That's not normal for a person to eat their drink mouthwash. So and the, you know, the criteria was a dog, because it's much more strict than the rest of it is a person, human consumption. This is canine consumption. But that is, there's no cosmetics really that a normal dog would eat as food. So creams, lotions, you don't have to look for the ingredients, and you don't have to look to see if it's on a list. It's all permissible for Pesach. Very strong halachic reasoning for that. So that's in terms of the inedible food. In terms of dog and cat food.
Kitchen's over?
Oh, so you have any questions on the kitchen?
Oh.
That's all you got to do. It should take you a half an hour to do your kitchen.
I had a question.
Yeah, sure.
Kitchen, like any advice on like dishes and
oh,
how
good
to
point.
Handle that
yeah.
way to
so,
paper.
So, no, let's divide this into
like
categories.
What you used to eat with.
Yeah.
Utensils.
So fire. Made out of metal, if it's made out of metal, then you could kosher it very easily. The way you kosher it is the way it's used. So for instance, you have a pot. It's normally used for soups and stuff like that. So it's, you have to pour water in it, boil the water, have it fall over the sides a little bit. You clean it first, obviously, so there's nothing, there's no chametz there. And once you do that, you put the lid on top, you know, and I usually put the lid in the oven to just as a backup, because it's hard to kosher a lid, as long as it's not gonna melt. Because some of them don't. Well, you have to be careful with that. I only do that with things that I know are not going to melt. But if they're going to melt, then you basically just have to clean it very well with soap. And then, you know, use it the way you normally use it, which means put it on top of the pot. And then you could use it for Pesach. And what I usually do is when I do the pots, I do the utensils at the same time. You could just throw all the utensils in, mix them around a little bit so that make sure that it all touches the hot water. It only has to be in there for like 15 seconds. And then it's now kosher for Pesach. You could use it for Pesach. Now, if you have pans, let's say, that are glazed with pyrite, what do they call that?
Teflon.
That's questionable whether that could be kosher. And I would avoid it, but if you have no choice, then you could burn that out by turning it upside down on the burner. If you have pans that don't have Teflon, then that's how you kosher those. On each side, but mostly many things inside that gets burnt out, and that koshers that. And then stuff like china and glass, it's better not to use that on Pesach. However, again, same thing. If you only use it for cold, there's just strong reasoning to say that you could use it for Pesach. You just have to wash it out, because you never use it for hot chametz. Like, you don't need oatmeal out of your glassware. So if someone really needs to use their glassware in Pesach, I don't see any reason why they can't use it, as long as they didn't use it for very hot chametz. And even there, there's logic to say you can do it. But if you know that you use it for very hot chametz, then I would say it's okay to use it. And that includes china. And china is interesting also, because china is a hybrid. It's a kli cheres. The inside part is like pottery, and then it's glazed with glass on the outside. So the question comes up whether it has a halacha of glass or has a halacha of pottery. And it would seem as halacha for this as halacha of glass. I'm lenient when it comes to toveling. Moshe Feinstein said that you could treat it like pottery for toveling. Glass needs toveling in a mikveh, but pottery does not. So Chassam Sofer says that you need to tovel china, and that's why a lot of people do it. But there are other opinions that you don't have to. So I'm lenient when it comes to that. But here, I think there's a lot of strong reasoning to say that this is a different thing. That question is, what kind of dish is this? Is it pottery? Is it glass? Well, glaze doesn't make the item. It's the item is made out of pottery. It's just glaze. It's a glazed pottery, right? So that's not called glass. That's not what the rabbi said you had to tovel. or the Torah, depending on which point of view you take. But when it comes to this issue, the question is, did food go in? So all we care about that is the outer layer. The outer layer is glass. So then you can be lenient when it comes to the outer layer. So there is a strong argument to be made that China did not receive any taste of chametz in it. Now, I would not rely on that outright, unless it's like a very serious situation. Like if it's someone's house, someone else's house, or you have nothing else to use. So ideally, if you have hot pastas and stuff like that, chametz, on your dishes, you shouldn't use those dishes for Pesach. But I just want to be, make this clear, because people go crazy about this kind of thing, and it's not worth going crazy over, because there's a strong opinion to say that it's okay to use. So I'm not saying that you should use it, but if someone else uses it, or if you go to someone's house and you're stuck, you didn't eat a piece of bread because you had someone else's china, because there's a strong argument to be made that's kosher. Yeah.
What about that thing if you haven't used any something for over a year? Where does that fit in?
So we said that 24-hour rule is that's very well based. 24-hour rule. 24-hour rule says after 24 hours, the food, any food that's found in the pores of this utensil becomes spoiled. That's a rabbinical rule that basically says if you use the item after 24 hours, there's no taste anymore. That's going to make it not kosher. Then there's another thing. The year thing is a minority opinion, but it became famous because of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he said that you could rely on this opinion that says that after a year, not only does it become spoiled, but it becomes completely gone, right? Which I don't know the difference, really, because spoiled is also allowed, but this is like completely gone. So that you don't even have to... The reason is because you normally would have to kosher, an item after 24 hours, even though it's spoiled, because it's a rabbinical restriction, you have to do that. But in the case where it's a year and he combines with other factors, he says that since it's completely gone and since it's going to be a financial loss, et cetera, he permits it. So the year thing does help. I actually asked this question, someone called me up and asked me a question about kosher. And usually I'm able to say, don't worry, it's fine, don't worry. This one was a tough one. I couldn't think of a way out of it. So I called the big rabbi and asked him what to do. So he told me very, very, because basically I was, their case, they had to throw out the pot, throw out the plate. I don't want them to throw out their plate. They can't use it forever. So the rabbi said to me, you could put it aside, put the date, wait a year, and then you could use it again. I was like, phew. I got out of this one. It was Basar Bechal of Daraisa in a Kli Rishon. Yeah, right? That's a very severe level. It was a first level pot, whatever, a dish that can't be koshered, that was milk and meat. It was like bad. It was like a bad situation. So that's how I got out of it. So there's some ways to use that rule.
Kosher and use something for milk and meat, if it's not used for a year, you can use it.
So that's what he told me. He told me that after, if it became not kosher for milk and meat, but this was seriously not kosher. It was like Pyrex that you put in the oven. It's not like a plate. A plate has different rules than something you put in the oven. Much more lenient if you use it just for a plate. But but he told me that you take the non-kosher pot, tie it up, put it in a bag, write the date, and a year later you could use it. That's what he told me. Same thing, doesn't matter what. This is worse. This is the worst thing possible. Basar Bechal, milk and meat is the most complicated thing to the kosher. It's worse than shrimp.
So, the pottery and glass, I thought they were sort of the same, but which of them is least susceptible to re-koshering?
Least susceptible?
Or which one can you kosher?
So, pottery you cannot kosher.
Okay, you can't because it's so porous.
Because it's so porous.
Right.
Glass.
If it's covered with glass,
that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's covered with glass, so it would have a halacha of glass.
Okay.
And there's three opinions about glass.
Right, glass is controversial.
Right. One opinion says the glass is like pottery. One opinion says the glass doesn't get anything like you guys said. And the third opinion says it's like metal.
Oh.
So that if it's like metal, then it can be kosher like anything else. So that's why it's advantageous, like Ann said, to the glass bottom, to cut, you could kosher it, and it makes a difference according to that opinion that says it's like metal because it could be kosher. No problem. So now we're up to, anyone have any other question about the kitchen? No?
So, does everybody hold that opinion about the spraying Windex on?
No. No, if you go online, no one says that. Except the only one I've heard from, I gave that class last year, sermon, yeah. And then someone was in the audience and they came over to me and said that their rabbi said the same thing, but they also said there's a big shul in Teaneck. And everyone jumped all over him and doesn't say that anywhere and where'd you get it from and like, but if anyone knows the laws well, it's like so logical, it's just so obvious. But you will not find that on the internet. And I only discovered this concept because I did a lot of research, because you have to do your own research for this type of thing. But there's multiple reasons why. If you want to listen to it. It's a long thing why that's the case, but I gave a sermon on it and it's on the internet. So it's called countertops or something, laws of countertops.
So if somebody asks, it's okay to say that?
That what? Well, say your rabbi, 100% say your rabbi said it's okay.
Well, if somebody asked me what I could cover my counters for Pesach, say, do I do aluminum foil or I do Windex?
I always say it depends on your situation. If you're going to have people over that are going to freak out because you don't cover your counters, then that's a different story. But if the person will accept your explanation that you Windexed it and whatever you want to say, that you did what you have to do to kosher it, you don't have to get into details. You just say you did what you have to do to kosher it, and it's kosher for Pesach, and they'll accept it, then that's the way you go. So because this way, it changes everything. Because if you have to cover your counters, that adds potentially, an hour, 2 hours to your cleaning thing. If you just have to use Windex and do this plan, it should, especially if cleaning helps, shouldn't take you more than a half an hour to do the kitchen.
You could use an all-natural cleaner too. It doesn't have to
as long as it's something that will make the crumbs inedible.
Something that you can't eat.
It doesn't have to be poisonous.
It does have to be.
It
does not have to be.
Right.
Okay.
But it's just be something that will make it inedible. Like if you. Like soap. Soap. It's like soap. Soap is fine. Yeah. I mean, if you put. Think about it. If you have a Cheerio and or Cheerio crumbs and you put soap on it, you're not going to go, Right. So anything that you. That's the guideline. The guideline is anything that you would not. Eat it afterwards. Like water, plain water, you would eat it. So it has to be something more than just plain water. It has to be something like soap, where if you poured soap, put soap on it, you wouldn't eat it anymore. So that level. But I like, the reason I like Windex and all that stuff, it's chemicals and everything, but it's in halacha at least, it's a little better because of the poison and, the fact that no one would ever eat it. That makes it a little stronger and, it's better to be stronger because, like I said, this is a little bit controversial. Shouldn't be, but it is. And if you say this argument with the Windex, it's just very hard to argue against. So, that's basically the kitchen, the house. So that according to this plan, we're talking about. I think especially if cleaning help shouldn't take you more than an hour to do this whole thing, your whole house.
But if you don't have cleaning help.
Don't have cleaning help, so it takes you a little longer. It won't take you that long, a little bit longer, It's not so hard to Windex your counters. The long thing is the refrigerator. Refrigerators and freezer is more complicated. You have to identify the chametz and put it away. That's also that's a little tedious. You need to make sure you find everything in your refrigerator, because sometimes there's things in your refrigerator for a year, and you're like, you forget about it, and it's buried under stuff. You got to find that stuff, make sure there's no chametz lying around here. At least not identified. So that's in terms of preparing cleaning. And then we have the dog food. It's dog and cat food. So the problem with dog and cat food is there is a restriction, rabbinical restriction, from benefiting from chametz. One may not benefit from chametz. So it doesn't extend to things like owning stock in Krispy Kreme, which some posts can say you're not allowed to own stock in Krispy Kreme because of the chametz. But it doesn't apply to that. But it does apply to other benefits, like a pet. So,
like
a pet. So one does not have to worry about kidney oat when it comes to these things. So only thing to worry about the 5 grains, if it has wheat, spelt, oats, barley, and rye in it. And most dog and cat foods do have those ingredients. So it is an issue. Some people feed their animals raw food, whatever, not raw, I mean cooked food, but I mean regular food. It happens to be, I found for cats at least, and I know the dog version is the same, a chametz-free cat food, which is, it happens to be the cat food I use the whole year anyway. So it's great. Called Core. So
anyone that's marked grain-free would be okay, or is there something else you
have? I don't know.
Because I just bought one today that says grain-free.
Well, I have like these granola bars that say gluten-free. I say, oh man, can I have a Pesach?
Not gluten-free.
And then it says oats.
Grain-free.
There's oats in it. No, oats don't have gluten?
No, they're not gluten.
Okay. So grain-free probably
grain-free
is okay.
Is.
But I like to go through every ingredient just to make sure.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't understand that logic that you're benefiting from feeding your pet.
What do you mean? You, of course, you're better. You want your pet alive. You like your pet. You don't.
But it just seems. I don't know. It just seems. I mean, you're nurturing a pet. You're giving them, sustaining them.
I mean, you're paying for the cat food, right? You're paying for the dog food.
That's true.
So that means you're benefiting from that food. That's why you bought it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It just seems different when you're just sustaining a.
I'll tell you how far this goes. There are some. The Yerushalmi says that even if you feed a stray dog, it can't feed a stray dog chametz. Mm-hmm. And the reasoning is really hard to understand.
Yeah.
They said that since you feel good when the dog eats because of you, which is really, that's what some say. I mean, I don't get that. That's taking a pretty far benefiting. But that's how far it could go. So certainly if it's your own pet, you have to worry about benefiting from it. But so, but there's lists on that. Those lists you can look on the internet for. They have lists of chametz-free cat, dog, fish food. What?
Where do you get the dog food or the cat food?
Oh, they sell it everywhere. It's a very famous brand. It's Core.
Core. Core. Core. He's talking about. But there's other brands too.
Yeah. But that brand,
Science Diet has.
So that's that. Now in terms of. Yeah, that's fine.
Mm-mm.
No, as a matter of fact, not only does it have to be kosher meat, but it's very funny that you mentioned that because it says the dogs, when they left Egypt, did not bark the whole night, and the Torah says this, and the Medrash says that they were rewarded because later on it says lakel tashlichan also that when you have non-kosher meat, you should give it to your dog. And that's the reward for them being quiet for exodus from Egypt. So this really fits the Pesach perfectly, pets.
You can have non-kosher meat in your house, but you can't.
Well, if non-kosher dog and cat, if you have a pet and you need not, and you have non-kosher food for your dog or cat, for whatever reason, you should make sure it's just like chametz. It's really separate from the other food and wrapped up. I mean, the cat food that I serve, I have a whole system. We'll give my cat loves wet, one of my cats loves wet food and he actually cries for it every morning, chai. So I have to make him his wet food. He like rubs against my legs, where's my wet food? So I have this whole system. I have to go to the bathroom because I don't want to take the tray food into the kitchen. And I put it in a plastic bag. I have a whole thing, system, how to do it. But I keep it separate from the other food. I keep it in the fridge also, but I just keep it in a plastic bag, completely sealed, tied up. So that and labeled so that no one's going to eat it anyway. I mean, no one's going to look at, oh, look, cat food, delicious.
It's interesting that you're allowed to feed your dogs like non-kosher food.
Right.
Not,
so it's not always true because if it's milk and meat, you can't.
Okay. Oh.
Milk and meat can't benefit from. There's certain foods you're not allowed to benefit from.
Yeah, it's a different concept.
Right. So in other words, there's levels. Yeah. Milk and meat's really the weirdest thing. You can't cook it. If you cook it and don't eat it, it's also violating a biblical prohibition. Really strange. It's the only one like that. And then you can't eat it, which is normal, and then you can't benefit from it. And chametz is can't eat it, and you can't benefit from it. So regular non-kosher just can't eat it. You're allowed to benefit from it. So it depends on the different levels. What?
You can store it.
Store what?
You can store it.
If you sell it.
You can sell it, no, what I'm saying.
You can't store it.
Basic prohibition.
That's what Ralph said.
Oh,
I see. Yeah, chametz cannot be owned by you or in your possession, even if it's not yours. Right? You can't have chametz on your property even knowingly or own the chametz. There's a funny case in the Chuvas of Rabbi Akiva Eger, I think it was, that someone who inherited on Pesach a cookie factory. No dehuda, that's a no dehuda. Cookie factory in Pesach. And he was afraid that he's not allowed to use the cookies anymore because it's chametz shel avo Pesach. You know, it's chametz that you owned on Pesach. He can't use it anymore. So he lost his whole inheritance. But he figured out a way out of it. The other thing is, Center City is really important to go over what you're allowed to buy in the stores, because we don't have a kosher supermarket here. And going to a kosher supermarket is really difficult. So it's important to know what we could buy in a regular supermarket. And really, this is something also that I think is false advertising, that we find that the articles on the internet say you can absolutely not eat anything that doesn't have a hechsher for Pesach. And I dispute that vehemently because even though there's the rule is that even one crumb in a food make it not edible for not kosher for Pesach, but that only applies if it falls in on Pesach itself, right? Not if it falls in before Pesach. If it falls in before Pesach, one crumb, and since the ingredients have to be put in there, anything that's above 2%, so therefore it depends on the food. It's about 2%. So therefore, anything there that's not in the ingredients, you don't have to worry about it being nullified. I think it's 1%. You know, anything that's not listed in the ingredients is not something you have to worry about, even on Pesach. So people like all worried that you buy a yogurt, and who knows what's in the air? There could be like breadcrumbs flying through the air in the Yoplait factory, which is like, give me a break. That's not happening anyway. But even if that was the case, it's not listed in ingredients because it's just a minute amount, and it's nullified before Pesach. And then even though on Pesach itself it wouldn't be nullified and you couldn't eat it, but on Pesach, if it happened before Pesach, you can't eat it. So therefore, you don't have to worry about ingredients not listed when it comes to, and we went through this kosher-wise, why you're allowed to buy products even without a hechsher at all, if the ingredients are okay. You don't have to worry about the utensils that we spoke about. That's a little off topic, but the bottom line is that it is permissible to rely on ingredients for any food that's governed by the FDA, which is most food that you buy in a supermarket, because they police it. Rav Moshe Feinstein said that anything policed by the FDA is enough in terms of relying on the ingredients, that the ingredients that you see listed are the proper ingredients that are in the food and that they didn't put anything else in. So therefore, if you could read any ingredients and every ingredient is kosher Pesach, then you could purchase that item on Pesach, even though it doesn't have supervision at all, especially even if it doesn't have Pesach supervision or even any supervision. So the question is, what about kidney oat? So kidney oat really ruins a lot of foods, because there's a lot of foods use soy, lecithin, and corn syrup, and all this stuff. So my feeling is that the only things that are kidney oat, we're not going to add to injunctions. And people are adding things like left and right. They added sesame recently, they added green beans. A lot of things are added on. And the fact is that they added on soy, they added on corn, they added on peanuts. How do I know that? Because when they made this injunction, it was in Europe in the 1500s. And the soy did not get to Europe until the 1800s. And corn and what's his name? And peanuts. They didn't know what it was. Now, this injunction to begin with is crazy. It doesn't make any sense. It should not apply nowadays. However, there's nothing we could do about it, because the only book of law that we accepted as Jewish people is the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. And we are bound by that Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch says straight out, at least the Rama says, the Ashkenazi Shulchan Aruch, says you're not allowed to eat beans. The custom is not to eat beans and rice. So we don't do that. However, my feeling is you should not add on to that. So if soy and corn and peanuts didn't exist, and technically speaking, you should really be allowed to have rice and and beans anyway. So I'm not saying you definitely should not eat rice and beans, but why am I adding things on? So the things that they add on beyond rice and beans, I think, are permissible. And not only that, but especially if it's mixed into food. So for instance, if you have a go to Old Nelson downstairs, which I do every year on Pesach, and I look at the ice creams, Häagen-Dazs ice creams. So there's no way you could have the cookie dough. There's no way you could have the cookie crunch, whatever, the cookie cream, cookies and cream. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about an ice cream that has...
Strawberry.
Let's say strawberry ice cream. Strawberry. So it has soy lecithin in it. And therefore, they'll never get a heksher because soy is kidney oat. Well, guess what? Soy is not kidney oat, number one. Number two, which you're not aware of, the halacha is that kidney oat is very lenient since it's not really inherently wrong, not kosher. And it, even on Pesach, if it got mixed into another food and it's less than 50% of the food, 50%, if it's 49% of the food, you're allowed to eat it on Pesach. So that being the case, soy lecithin is 2% of the food, 3% of the food, 5% of, I mean, how much is it? How much lecithin is in there? I mean, come on. So therefore, not only is it not kidney oat, but even if it was kidney oat, it should be permissible. And that same thing goes true for all soda. Soda that says corn syrup is the reason why. Corn, first of all, did not exist in Europe if it's not kidney oat. Second of all, corn syrup is liquefied, and many opinions say liquid kidney oat is permissible. If you turn a bean into a liquid bean, even bean is not permissible, or rice milk, that's permissible. Some say that if you completely change it, like they do in the laboratory with corn, that's permissible, and it's less than 50%. So all those things together, to me, you could buy any soda that the only issue, if the issue is corn syrup, you don't have to look for kosher Pesach soda. Any item like cream cheese is fine, usually. Just, my advice is you look at every ingredient, because you never know. People aren't aware, they look, they say it says malt. You have to know what ingredient is. Malt is barley. Now, most people know that, but a lot of people don't. And there's a lot of ingredients that are like, what's that? And then you'll find out that it's a derivative of wheat, you know? So you should just be sure that you know exactly what every ingredient is. But if you do know what every ingredient is, and there's no chametz in there, and the only issue is kidney oat that is really not kidney oat, because it's soy or rice or soy or corn, or if, even if it's rice is less than 50%, I would say you could rely on that too. That one may eat those foods on Pesach. So, you have a question about kidney?
Yeah. Yeah. So, what's the basis for relying on a food that's not doesn't have kosher Pesach heksher? Because 2% is more than shishim.
No. So the amount is usually less than shishim. I'll tell you why it doesn't matter anyway. But it is. I think it's 1% anyway. So.
Right. 1%.
It has to be listed. If it's more than 1%, it has to be listed. Not 2%, it's 1%. But even if it was 2%, it's still okay for various halachic reasons. One of it is that you're talking about a very small percentage, and that's called a miut, should be a miut, a tiny percentage. And even a biblical prohibition is permissible with a tiny percentage, number one. Number two, it's for sure a very strong doubt. It's not listed. Why all of a sudden would they not list? The one thing they didn't list was the pig, you know? That was the one thing they didn't list. It's very, very rare. So there's two levels of mute. One level is only like a point between 1.67% and 2% chance. You know what I'm saying? That small difference amount is the amount that you're worried about.
Yeah, multiple ingredients less than 1% too. Like you got 300 ingredients all at 0.8%.
So I don't understand. Oh, so you're saying they combine together?
Cumulatively, yeah. Is that
so this, first of all, this logic applies to that even more so, because why am I assuming that there's three ingredients in here that are chametz? But there's another halacha called zev zagarim. Zev zagarim means that if you have two foods, and they mix them together and they combine together to make something not kosher, it doesn't work. Why? Because we say that the the one food nullifies the other food. In other words, when you analyze those three pieces of chametz, you don't say that they're combined. You say the two foods are different than the third food. So they combine to nullify the third food, and the same thing for the other two. That's the halachot zev zegarim. And that's what I use, by the way, that when you see artificial flavors, artificial colors, so the kashrus agencies will say you can't eat that because you never know, there might be grape juice in it. So I say, first of all, grape juice in America is all flash pasteurized, and that makes every single grape juice in America kosher, including Welch's grape juice. That's number one. So the item itself is not. But even if it wasn't kosher, let's say it's something like a red dye that's made out of bugs, right? But the dye is not the only dye. There's other dyes together with it, right? So it's called zev zegorim. So there's other reasons why dyes are okay, but this is a very important logic that artificial colors, A, you don't know that there's grape juice in it, so why do I have to worry about it? It's called a suffix drabanan after the case. I don't have to check it even to find out if it's there. Number two, even if you know for sure it was there, it's not the only flavor. There's grape flavor combined with apple flavor, combined with lemon flavor. There's a lot of flavors together, artificial flavors, artificial colors. So those other flavors will nullify the grape juice. And because they all work together to get the taste. It's not just grape juice as a flavor. So that's one of the many pieces of logic you could use to explain why artificial colors, artificial flavors are okay. And that answers one of the many answers to your question as to why you don't have to worry about the minor ingredient. The main reason is because it's not there. So why should I have to worry about something not there, right? Why should I assume that they put bread in there? How many companies do that? It's just not done. There's no reason to assume.
So you're saying corn and peanuts are okay?
Yeah.
And are there any particular oils that we have to be careful of?
So is there such a thing as rice or rice vinegar there is?
So maybe the rice, the wheat.
So yeah. If it's soy sauce is very problematic because that's made out of wheat. That's chametz. That's not even kidneys. So soy sauce is very problematic. And also teriyaki sauce. These kind of sauces you should be very careful with. Because you read the ingredients, you see the first ingredient is wheat. So
just look at
ingredients is a really good way to make sure. I mean, very careful. You buy something without supervision, I'm not saying, oh, have a great time. You know, you got to look at every ingredient and be careful. But I am saying have a great time after you read the ingredients. Once you read the ingredients and it's not there, party on. So we could stop here, but because it's over an hour already. So, but I have no problem staying for to continue the question.
Oil is fine, right?
I don't think so. What's made out of it?
Wheat?
I don't think so.
No. Isn't corn oil okay?
I think corn oil is okay, but again, you have to realize that if someone's eating at your house, they might freak out. So yeah. I'm not saying some people it doesn't matter. It's not going to affect anything. But I think corn oil is totally fine because corn is not kidney oat, and corn oil, according to some, is also, even if it was kidney oat, it's not kidney oat. So, and it's only a custom. Now, you have to keep the custom. But if it's a doubt on a custom or double doubt on a custom, that's for sure okay. And triple doubt on a custom, quadruple doubt on a custom, which is what we explained by a Coke, then there's no question. That would permit a biblical prohibition. Forget about a custom.
So olive oil would be fine. Let me hear a question.
Olive oil for sure is fine. Even the kosher agencies say that's okay.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Thank you
so much for coming.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Pleasure. But like I said, if anyone has questions or wants to deal with any topic that I didn't deal with, and I'm giving a class on Saturday afternoon next.
Same thing or different?
It's going to be similar, but, you know, basically I'll be fielding questions. A lot of people like to ask questions on Shabbos. So a lot of issues might come up. But it's next Shabbos, not this Shabbos.
Not this Shabbos.
It's a week from Shabbos.
Fantastic.
Who?
Fantastic.
No. It doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be kosher either. It's not food.
I know, but I've seen a heksher on cleaning.
Yeah. It's not food.